Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by Bella Catering. BellaCatering.com.au is where you can find Sydney's best catering company. And now they're doing home delivery. Check out what they've got. Get to it fast, Sydney. Victoria has already shut down, which is good. They're acting like idiots down in Victoria, but we are no less idiots here in New South Wales. So, my dear friends and listeners and folks, you, of course, have come across folks who are not doing the right thing with COVID-19. You need to contact Bella Catering while you can. Get the people to your house now that you want to visit. Check their temperature before they get in the door. Make sure that they're hand sanitized. Feed them with some delicious Bella Catering food. BellaCatering.com.au. They are responsible for the show. This week, we must thank them. We must love Glenn and Maria and thank their team and everything they do. Now, let's get on to the show.
There was good in him. He had been a good vice president, but he was a fatally flawed man and a fatally flawed president.
Richard Nixon, a guy who had been a hero to millions of Americans. Here's a guy who received more votes than anybody else in the history of this country. But the Richard Nixon that they supported through the years was not the Richard Nixon that they thought they knew.
To think that we're the only generation that had that experience is probably the mistake that a lot of generations make.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me today, it's exciting. We've only had one other person who's actually been in the mix of the political machine internationally so far in the show. I'm super excited to talk about people who are currently in the mix. And I think it's even more interesting for our international listeners when we get to talk about it from a local perspective, which excites me the most. I have a former journalist at Sydney Morning Herald and The Age and the Australian Associated Press who crossed the line after being a foreign correspondent in Indonesia, and he's now press secretary for the Shadow Minister for Industrial Relations, Mr. Tony Burke. And I have it on good authority that he continues to be on the lam from a theft of an All the President's Men DVD from Bathurst Video Easy circa 2003. His confession is here, but I think the statute of limitations is far gone. 17 years for a non-return DVD from Bathurst Video Easy is far gone. It's my pleasure to welcome Adam Gartrell to the show. Adam, thanks so much for being a part of the show, mate.
My pleasure, Blake.
So here we are. So cool to talk to you. Is it a weird thing for someone who has been a journalist and your beat was, you know, covering, you know, being in the depths of Canberra, which is Australia's sort of equivalent, you know, the ACT is Australia's equivalent to DC. Is it a strange thing to sort of cross the aisle, as it were, from journalism to politics and kind of what, you know, if this was your movie, the movie of journalists doggedly, you know, holding politics to account, you know, what is it like to now cross the aisle and go into something and be passionate and be like, all right, well, I'm actually going to follow my passion here and I'm going to go into politics and I'm going to see if I can affect change. Like, what is the journey for that?
So I guess, you know, I mean, I was and remain passionate about journalism. You know, I remain passionate about the idea of the Fourth Estate and holding the powerful to account. And I think I always will. There are a range of reasons that I sort of, you know, cross the aisle, as it were, you know, some professional, some personal. And, you know, I guess you're talking about the professional reasons. It's not just that, yes, I was, you know, drawn to sort of the progressive side of politics, but the media in Australia isn't doing so great. You know, in my last 5 years in journalism, I went through 4 redundancy rounds at AAP and then at Fairfax. So it was just this existential constant threat of, you know, the sort of Damocles hanging over you. So I kind of got a bit tired of that.
I can imagine.
And it's still happening.
I think you on the other side are seeing it up close and personal as well, with just, you know, different media organizations. You know, our current, you know, government is scrutinizing its own broadcaster, you know, based on external political influences, is, you know, scrutinizing its own broadcaster and saying, should this operate as a private thing? Should we even do this anymore? So funny when the things that hang over from our Commonwealthness just happen to be in competition with other things. But yeah, no, it's something that, and especially in Australia, since November, with everything that happened with the bushfires and how critical, like, Johnny on the spot journalism was to actually help save lives, direct people to safety, all those sorts of things. And then particularly with COVID-19, just the consumption, because the numbers, you know, the numbers, even from a culture perspective, are still huge. Like, websites are still getting read, and sometimes in greater number in certain sites. But it's then about, like, the advertising dollar that sometimes funds those people are like, well, we have no money to advertise because our businesses have been crippled by COVID-19. So it's like this weird thing of like, well, you've set it up on this base where people, you know, where you're not offsetting with subscribers, or there's different business models, and it's that whole thing of like, does our population support it completely, all that jazz. So it's this weird thing, and it's still happening, and it's happening in a national broadcaster, and it's happening all over the place at the moment.
Yeah, and look, you know, COVID-19 kind of accelerated a lot of those things that were underway, things that might have taken 4 or 5 years have happened in 6 months.
Yes.
But now, I mean, you know, when I first joined the Canberra Press Gallery, I think it was 2007, and I thought to myself, you know, I would never go and be a political staffer because it's so insecure. It's like, if your MP falls over in a scandal or is sacked from the front bench or whatever, then you're out of a job, right? So you're at the mercy of this personality. In the 10 years or so subsequent, that paradigm has completely flipped. You know, now I would look at journalism and go, I don't know if I could go back to that constant threat of the axe, and political staffing kind of seems quite secure by comparison. But anyway, yeah.
I think that that's a fun way to enter this movie, because, you know, this movie between now and then is like, it's chalk and cheese, you know, like people who were political staffers at the time were absolutely at the time in America in, you know, 72 to 74 that this film charts, you know, would have absolutely said the same thing. It's very safe to be in a paper and in a big city paper and in a big city that has got such an international footprint around all of our, you know, diplomacy that has to happen everywhere. That's a safe town to be in a paper.
Yeah.
Because you're going to be a metro person. You're going to be in the press gallery for politics. You're going to have, you know, whatever the case may be, you might be on international, but it's going to be important. You're going to be at the coal face and you're going to be very secure for a very long time. I spoke to a guy by the name of Craig Lindsay, an American journalist, and he said he was heading into Houston just as he was starting out as a journalist. And there were two papers. I think there was like a Post there, like a Houston Post and a Houston Chronicle. I'm probably getting the names wrong. But he said he literally started at the Chronicle, and that week, the second paper in that town, the huge paper, went under. And he was like, whoa, like this was like competition thriving. Lots of stuff. And as soon as one goes down, it's like, oh, well, this whole profession maybe is kind of questionable from here on out.
Yeah, yeah. And that's right. You know, in the movie, Bob Woodward's been there, what, 8 or 9 months?
Nine months,
right, yeah. And, you know, back in those days, that was the start of a long, you know, decades-long career when he's, you know, would be totally secure.
Yes.
It's just not the way anymore, sadly.
So let's talk a little bit about this movie. Let's talk a little bit about taking you back to your, I guess, boots on the ground experiences, and then I'd love to, because it's so cool to talk to again a foreign correspondent who's working in a country that has like deep ties to Australia, and then there's questionable sort of diplomatic challenges of all those sorts of things that were in that coverage. So we might dive into the minute, because I think it might shake up a few things for us to talk about. This is the 69th minute, lucky you, the 69th minute of Alan J. Pakula's 1976, Alan J. Pakula and Robert Redford's 1976 masterpiece, All the President's Men. We are with Woodstein. They are on the front foot with the thank you very much to Kay Eddy, a printout of every single employee of CREET, which is the committee to re-elect the president, and are basically ascertaining who these people are, where they live, and sort of door knocking and hoping that someone's morality will compel them to sort of paint the picture of some of the really nasty and weird stuff that is going on behind closed doors in the committee to re-elect the president. And so it's such a fun, and I think this is, Manny Farber called it termite art. This is my favorite thing. I love doors. In a movie, when I watch doors being slammed in faces, I just want to say this is one of the things that inspires me to do this show, because it feels like you have to be equipped to have the doors slammed in your face to be successful, really, at anything. So I just love the experience of it. So Adam and I are going to watch it now together. You guys are going to listen along, and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
From the Washington Post.
Ammons, Irene Ammons, do we see her?
Abbott, Addis, Augusto, Albers.
There's something that strikes you as odd about this.
What?
Almost like there's a pattern to the way they're not talking, the way they're saying no all the time. I think that's odd.
Mrs. Hamblin?
Yes.
We're from the Washington Post.
I'm Carl Bernstein. This is Bob Woodward.
A friend at the committee said that we could contact you.
Who was it?
We can't reveal that.
You can talk to us. We don't reveal our sources.
You people. You think you can come into my home, ask a few questions, have me destroy the reputations of men that I work for and respect? Do you understand loyalty? Have you ever heard of loyalty?
Hi.
Yes.
Have you ever heard of loyalty, Adam?
I have. It's a big thing.
It is the thing. Mm. Such a great little minute. In a movie also, just for everyone, David Shire's score is incredible and pertinent to another project that's coming up on One Hit Minute Productions, The Zodiac Chronicle. David Shire also scored Zodiac. He's an incredible composer. And this is one of those times in the movie where the score makes you aware of it, because so much of the movie sort of digs into this authenticity aesthetic and soundscape. So you're just hearing, you know, the incidental sounds of newsrooms or cars driving or like ambient noise in a McDonald's or whatever the case may be, or the planes flying over the Q Hotel in Washington. But here it's like getting you into this sort of like lulling jazz of, I'm now going to have every door slammed in my face. And it's like the door slamming becomes the percussion to the music. It's a really great scene. And then it comes on to these guys trying to get information out of people who are unwilling to talk. How much of your journalistic career was that? does that hurt? Is there pangs of familiarity right there?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's like a perfect minute of kind of gumshoe journalism, right? Walking up to the stoop and knocking on doors. And you can just see their kind of forlorn expressions, and you know, we only see it for a minute, but they've obviously been doing this for days. And look, it's that kind of is more reminiscent for me of like the days when I was reporting crime and stuff. And you go to a crime scene and you'd have to knock on all the neighbors' doors and try and find witnesses to talk about what had happened, or the victim, you know, did they know the victim, all that sort of stuff. And you know, that was just, I hated that. I questioned my, you know, commitment to my craft and to my profession at times like that. I just hated it. You know, kind of known as the death knock. Whereas in political journalism, which I guess I did for about 10 years, it's much more phones getting slammed and phones getting hung up on you. You know, you're not so much knocking on the doors because you're sitting at your desk and you're going through your contacts and just trying to call as many people as possible. But, yeah, the same principle of people just not wanting to talk, and you know, you have to kind of try and penetrate through all those loyalties that they've got, whether it's themselves and their own.
As the recipient, right? So it's not only political allegiance, but the loyalty to individuals. I think that's what I love.
Yeah, that's right.
About this minute is, so much of this entire film, and I think what's so important about it and why people find it a bit of a balm, is that people get to, or the real heroism of this is people overcoming, you know, their interpersonal connections and relationships sometimes, or their political allegiances, to have like a moral moment and say, was I witness to something that was inherently wrong? And if that is the case, then how do I spill the beans on that? And what's cool in this minute is just the quandary. Like, this is my life. This this is my life. These are other people's lives. The stakes are larger. I think sometimes the stakes can be like put into perspective when you're like talking on an individual level. This is my life. This is my job. These people I work with, you know, me ratting on them in my mind right now is just not something that I'm willing to do. It's really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's that kind of, I think you mentioned it in the intro to the minute, is like loyalty versus morality, right? Like, where is that line? Where does your responsibility to your colleagues and to your party end?
Yes.
And a greater imperative, whether it be country or just, you know, right from wrong, when does that take over?
Yes. And now on the other side of the bench, it is that, like, that constant battle, the diplomacy of compromise. I think that's what this, maybe that's the whole bomb, is like that back then the most egregious thing you could do was attempt to spy on a political, you know, this is the most egregious thing in the 20th century politics was attempting to spy and disrupt the political campaign of another party. And on the stages of the Australian and the stages of the American political tussles that have happened over the last decade, that's just outward. You do that in a debate. You do it in an ad. You do it on the morning magazine shows that don't deserve a mention. It's like, it's that disruption is just happening like there. Like, you just it's on the front lines. There's none of this. There's no espionage. It's just like you just say the bad thing to disrupt them right in front of them. So it's a kind of a strange thought to happen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I have some faith that if a scandal like Watergate took place in Australia and was exposed, then people would still be held accountable.
Yeah.
If it was happening in the US now, I think the circus would have moved on 48 hours later and no one would be held accountable. It's just, you know.
Yeah, I think it's you know, it's thankfully hasn't been touched yet in the sort of cuts to the national broadcaster, the ABC in Australia, but like the Four Corners media program, like in its long history. And I think of like the weirdness of, there's a Queensland premier, for our American listeners, there's like a governor named Joe Bjelke-Petersen doing some of the strangest stuff. So I think you can even find the clips on YouTube and stuff like that. So the strangest governing policies you've ever seen. And like, you know, Four Corners did the massive expose, which like basically torpedoed his entire government. Like, this is weird. It's bad. There's like corruption. There's all this stuff. And it's like, I just think of those sorts of examples in Australian politics where, like, yes, people can get disrupted. People can get moved on, but I don't think Australian politics is as brazen, but there's a bit of a passive aggression. And I think you would know what that is like. It's like, I don't think anyone's as brazen to do that crazy stuff. And whenever you find out about corruption, whether it's on both sides of the aisle, it seems to be held in check and, you know, gets the necessary media attention. And usually there's the shame at least involved to retire or to move on. But, there's still a fair amount of, I think there's just this like, The best and worst thing about our relationship with America, because we're so infiltrated by its culture, is that we can go, oh, we're not quite as bad as that for some things. And we're like, no, we are. For that thing, we're actually really bad. The other thing, I kind of agree with you. Yeah, we're not as bad. Or like gun control, we do that great. We do that great. Yeah. There was one shooting. John Howard, one of the most famous conservative prime minister in this country ever, just like went, see ya. Guns, bye. Basically overnight in the country, hasn't been a mass shooting in the country ever since. So yeah, like there's definitely those arguments, but and then there's others.
I mean, we are, you know, there are some in the Australian body politic who would love to see us go down that Trumpism path, that populist path, right? And they're being held, you know, at the fringes for now, but a lot of the things they say are slowly getting mainstreamed. And, a lot of the space, you know, the condemnation that used to come from some of their comments, now it's like, well, let's have a discussion about it. Let's have a debate about it. And it's like, yeah, okay. You're just giving a platform to this, you know, to the same kind of populism. And look, I don't think it'll happen in any sort of sudden sudden way that we'll have some sort of right-wing populist slip into power the way Trump was. But it is there, and politicians recognise that there are similar undercurrents that they can exploit.
Yes.
And some of them will attempt to. And, you know, going back to Queensland, that often seems to start in Queensland.
So for anyone who's listening, because Adam and I will be talking probably a week or so before you actually hear this episode, there's an Australian, one of our commercial broadcasters, Channel 9 in Australia, has one of their flagship morning shows, The Today Show, has been for, I want to say at least since 1996, has been giving profile to an extremely right-wing, flat-out, racist senator in a variety of perspectives. She was a senator and then she was a disgraced senator, and then I think they put her on a Dancing with the Stars on one of our other commercial networks, and then she came back into the Senate by the name of Pauline Hanson. They put her on their show for like, and they literally got her as a talking head for the most controversial subjects. For I'm not kidding, like that's 23 years, count them, 23 years that they've kept this person in the public eye saying deplorable racist shit on the biggest platform in our country, like one of the biggest platforms in our country. And then they get her on to say that stuff. And right now in this particular political moment, people are insanely sensitive about that because of, you know, just, you know, whether it's this quarantine, whether it's the lockdown, whether it's just the moment in history that we're at, people are like, that's enough. Like, we don't need to hear from this person anymore. And they go, oh, sorry, she won't come in our network anymore. And it's like, mate, you don't need to just apologize for that appearance. You need to apologize for 23 years of giving that person that profile, because they would not even be a political entity had you not continued to give them a profile when they weren't a political entity. It's like, there was a hilarious one and even a more jokey one, which is like, the guy who's been playing Cleveland, this is like the super woke version of it at the moment, which is just ridiculous. The guy's been playing Cleveland in the Family Guy in the United States. He's like, I'm not going to play it. I'm going to give it to an African-American man. And in his sentence, he's like, at the end of the sentence, like, I've played Cleveland for 23 years. You're like, mate, you don't need to say sorry for like playing the role. You're rich. Fox have been paying you for 23 years. You've got like 8 houses. You don't need to say sorry for like 1 year or two. It's like 23 years. It's like Hank Azaria, the same thing. It's like, oh no, an Indian person should play Apu. Man, you've already made the money. What are you going to do? Totally. Give it back to the guy? Totally. Like, yeah, it's really,
yeah,
it is a really, it's a really interesting quandary right now. And people could just go, oh, well, it's this one appearance. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, you know, Pauline Hanson, okay, after 23 years, and I think she gets paid for her Today Show appearances, doesn't she? I'm not sure about that, but maybe she doesn't. But she is now out there leveraging it, right? And she's claiming to all her supporters, I've been silenced by the mainstream media. You know, they're silencing voices like yours. This is why you can't trust them. And it, you know, in a way, it strengthens her hand. So, you know.
This is
so it's a very Trumpian thing to do.
Oh man, you know, this is the thing, Adam. You would have probably a better understanding of anyone, better understanding almost of anyone that I've had on the show about a being a shoe leather crime journo. I know I've spoken to a couple of them, and that death knock has come up on the show several times. But then having an international footprint, and then also being in the press gallery in Canberra, and then now being a press secretary in politics, in progressive politics, because you're passionate about it. It's like watching this moment accelerate to this point and then seeing how internationally American politics is going to have an influence either positively or negatively from people like trying to capitalize on similar strategies or people like trying to squash that, you know, that ignorant voice that seems to sort of grab anger. It's not even objective anymore. It's not about a political difference. It's just about anger and distrust and fake news and all that nonsense. It's like, it's a really unique political moment right now. And you can, like you said, there's an opportunistic politics out there that like try and play the same game, play the same game plan. And then there's others who are like, no, we're not going to allow this. We're not going to allow this game plan happen in this country.
Look, I take some heart from the fact that, as you said, you know, Pauline Hanson has been around in politics for 25 years or something now. She doesn't actually increase her vote, right? Like her vote is stuck at around 5 or 6% of the national vote each election. It doesn't deviate from that. You know, it sort of waxes and wanes a bit in Queensland, in her heartland, but she hasn't managed to tap into the real centre or the mainstream. You know,
yes.
And I think her her brand of politics has a gradually corrosive effect on our debate and the things that are normal and the things that are acceptable. But I don't think she's a mainstream political force. And I don't think, at least in the near term, that anyone like her will be mainstream political force.
Just the makeup of our country, right? You know, we recently had a census. I don't know how much international countries do their censuses, but ours every 4 years. And even some of the stats from our last census was like 40% of people who live in Australia, their parents weren't born here. Mm. So, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, all the way back to World War II. So like my grandparents, you know, came over from one half of my family were Maltese and came over in that post-war move. A lot of Greek people came over at that time, a lot of Italians. We had a big European sort of surge of folk at that time that came all around the country. And then you get a whole bunch of a Lebanese population and Arabic population that came over, you know, during, civil war that were happening over in those countries, and then Sudanese folk. And it's just like, and then obviously, you know, we're in Asia. So there's a lot of Asian migrants that come over, whether it's Vietnamese, whether it's, you know, Chinese, etc. And so it's like the makeup of our country doesn't feel like by hook or by crook is like, it doesn't feel like those things, those voices are going to get any easier to go out there. They just seem even more to the fringe. You just feel like now's the time for those voices to be squashed and actually have some progressive, rational conversation about multiculturalism in the country.
Yeah. The thing is, you know, I think those populist voices, they don't just exploit race, right? They exploit all sorts of fears.
Yes.
And a lot of the migrant community is quite conservative, right? So, you know, they are socially conservative. They might be against gay marriage, or they might be against, you know, some of those other progressive causes.
Yes.
And so it's not quite as easy as saying migrant communities won't have truck with those sort of voices.
Yes.
You know, they do find ways to appeal to them as well. But that is part of the melting pot, right? You have all these, you know, different groups of people, different demographics. You're trying to unite as many of them as possible around some sort of unifying paradigm or ideal or whatever. It's complicated. But yeah, I think ultimately you're right that there's something about the Australian character, about our multicultural character, that isn't allowing those voices to take over the debate. You know, they're there. They're annoying. I think they're given too much prominence by the gatekeepers, by the people who should be holding them back.
Yes.
But yeah, like I say, I don't think they're taking over anytime soon.
Yeah, some talent bookers in Australia need to be fired.
Absolutely.
They talk about it at there's a sort of. I'm a big comedy fan, so I listen to lots of comedy programs, and they talk about the Comedy Store in LA, and it was this legendary place where Mitzi Shaw, you know, oversaw people like Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy and Martin Lawrence, all these people come to emergence, and then it sort of, you know, 80s and 90s went to hell, and they had really bad, corrupt kind of talent bookers who had their own little cliques of people and let a lot of bad stuff go on, and people didn't want to hang out there because it was kind of an awful scene. And then another great person, you know, that person got kicked out, and a new era of people came in and they started booking all this talent and people want to go back. And it's just like, that's, I think there's a lot of great progressive, talented voices that are out there, or just even diverse voices that are out there that are like waiting in the wings. But in the past, they're like, well, if I'm always getting overlooked by this person, why do I want to go on this show? Or I'm going to be just a talking head to an ignorant other box, you know? I don't want to have that dialogue. Let's jump out of Australian politics for a moment. I want to get back to the most fascinating and inflammatory revelation of this podcast so far. What made you so desperate to have this movie in 2003 in Bathurst for Video Easy that you kept your copy? I want to know all about it. I want to know what. So I'm assuming, was that where you were from? You were originally from Bathurst, or you were unioning out there? Because there's usually a huge university population in Bathurst, which is a big rural town in New South Wales in Australia.
So I'm from Orange, which is nearby, similar neck of the woods, kind of country New South Wales. As soon as high school finished, I buggered off to Bathurst to study journalism. So I started in 2002, I think. I really wanted to see the movie, but I didn't have any money. so actually, an even more interesting wrinkle to this is my former roommate. How I stole it was basically my former roommate had moved out and he'd left some of his junk lying in the house. He'd moved back to Sydney or wherever he was from, and he'd left some of his stuff, including his video easy card. So I basically just used his video easy card to take out a bunch of DVDs, including all the President's Men, and I just held on to them. Now, I'm pretty sure he would have got chased by debt collectors or whatever, but that was the last I ever heard of it. But the interesting thing is that that roommate now works for Prime Minister Scott Morrison.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah. Anyway, I've still got the DVD. I was just telling you before the podcast, I've recently moved house, so they're in boxes somewhere, but I've certainly still got it, and I break it out every now and then. But, yeah, I guess back in 2003, you know, I was a 19-year-old. Watergate.
Passionate journalism student.
Exactly, yeah. You know, I was pretty sure I was going to be the next Woodward or Bernstein and was trying to see how it's done. You know, it's just it's a rite of passage for every journalism student, I think, to see the film and read the book and read the history.
Yeah, I think that you and I were at uni around the same time doing completely different subjects, and I think that, like, of our generation and before, it is absolutely the quintessential journalism film. And I think if you just take it even 5 or 6 years after, you get to the Shattered Glass era. And I feel like then some people go, it's the Shattered Glass, the Insider era, because it's like the emergence of sort of corporate journalism entities, you know, big conglomerates that own journalism companies or whatever the case may be, you know, whether it's papers or television shows or whatever the case may be. So they own all these things. And so some of the journalists I've spoken to are like still currently working, but probably were just like 1 or 2 years after you and I, they're like, nah, Shattered Glass was my formative thing, or The Insider was my formative thing. And then even later, there's like a spot, like a really late, it's like, oh, Spotlight's my thing. Like Spotlight's the one. And
or,
so,
or season 5 of The Wire.
Season five of The Wire. Yeah. Absolutely. Season five of The Wire is directed by the star journalist, the crooked journalist, Tom McCarthy directs Spotlight. So, you know,
that's right.
A nice little connection there. But yeah, season 5 of The Wire, those sorts of things, and then you can even, you know, branch off. But season 5 of The Wire does what kind of Spotlight is doing as well is it's right on the cusp of what we now know as like contemporary journalism spaces. You know, it's, you know, there's still papers being printed. There's still hard deadlines for print, but there's so much more of this online like prominence and prescience of journalists, you know, that have to deal with now, you know. So even my friend Maria Lewis, who's been on the show a couple of times, she talks about, you know, starting out at the Gold Coast Bulletin and was writing some of their first blogs for the Gold Coast Bulletin in Queensland. So that's like circa, you know, the time that you're at uni as well, like 2003-ish is like the first kind of blogs start to appear for mainstream papers. But yeah, I think it is a rite of passage movie. I think you have to watch it. How often have you revisited it? Is it one that you come back to?
To be honest, when I watched it for prep for this podcast, it was probably been about 10 years since I watched it. I would have watched it, I don't know, 8 or 9 times back in the day. Yeah. You know, it was a fairly constant thing. I used to watch it with my journalism school buddies, you know, where our dreams of grandeur. But yeah, no, it has been a while. And it was really refreshing because a lot of those more modern takes on newsrooms that you mentioned there, whether it's season 5 of The Wire or Shattered Glass, are pretty damn depressing.
Yes.
You know, it's, you know, and like season 5 of The Wire, the first scene, I think, in the newsroom is one of the seasoned correspondents taking a redundancy, right, as they downsize their newsroom, just kind of setting the scene of the decline of that institution, which is what The Wire is all about, right, the decline of American institutions. And that's season 5 of The Wire in a nutshell in terms of the newsroom. It is kind of – and also, you know, that strain of distrust against the media. Spotlight was maybe the recent exception. But there are very few movies or TV shows now that show journalists in a good light, in a heroic light.
Yes.
Right? It's mostly pretty murky moral territory, and it's mostly talking about, you know, people having to make stuff up because they don't have the resources to actually go out and do journalism anymore, or, you know, cutting corners. So, yeah, it's...
There was a fun dialogue recently about The Wire. And someone was asking, you know, is The Wire propaganda? Because there's been a lot of focus on police, you know, corruption in the police and violence in the police and internationally, definitely, and locally too, and saying, is the wire propaganda? And I think what was great is like David Simon and people that came to the defense is like, this entire show is about the decay of American civilization and literally season by season takes on a new institution. What do you want to take on this year? Okay, cool. We're going to take on the top levels of police and actually show how they, you know, everything that they have to do to do a rigorous investigation and do it right. We're also going to show them the lengths that they'll go to sensationalize something, to be corrupt, to do the right thing. And everything's muddied and murky. We're going to show you how corrupt schools and school institutions are. We're going to take you through to local policing, and we're going to definitely show you docs and unions, how that can go as bad as it can get. Because again, there's no money, there's no attention, there's no political power there. You know, people clutching for these things that are all in their last gasp. And it's like, you know, I think it was quickly sort of denounced as this entire show is an examination of the decline of American civilization.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, some of the main cop characters in the show are likable, sympathetic characters, still morally murky often, but they're likable, they're relatable. But the whole show is about even those good people butting up against the systemic problems, and they can't overcome those barriers to do the right thing because it's just the system is fucked.
And it drives them to do crazier and crazier and more violent and brutal shit, like that as it goes on, you know, as it goes on. But yeah, no, I think it's just, I'm always interested to see where you find it. This is a movie, and it just by convenience, you know, now with video on demand, like I'm sitting in my office with you, I'm looking at my shelves, I can see things. But when you go onto your video on demand thing, sometimes that like Netflix thing just scares me. There's just too many movies. It takes me too long to choose. So I'll occasionally jump onto my Apple TV and I just look, and All the President's Men's at the top left. That's A. I put it on, and if, you know, even if you just want to put something on the screen to distract you while, you know, tidying up or doing something or getting dinner ready or whatever, usually when my kids are in bed or have toddled off to bed or in their naps or whatnot. And so you do that, and it just, that's where it ensnared me. I just was so hypnotized by it. And you're right, it is a lionized portrayal of journalists, but I also just love, I don't know, it's such a city movie. It's such a Washington, D.C. movie. You feel like you know the whole landscape of the place. You feel like the walls are speaking to you. And just all the characters. And at that time, that exactly like you said, being compelled to do the moral thing despite a political allegiance, like and that not being capitalized upon necessarily, because you're like, no, we're going to do the right thing here. Nixon's not the right guy. If he's going down to the depths here and doing these nasty things. And you feel like Republicans are in agreement with that. They're in chorus with like, this guy is no good for us. And we can find another candidate that is better, where in our contemporary time, it feels like no matter what Trump has done, or no matter even some Australian politicians, no matter what their weird or backward opinions are on things, it's like there's nothing that person could say, even if it's downright wrong or bad, that like seems to change people's minds, or even just like pause and reflect and go, okay, well, I don't agree with him on that. It's a harder conversation to have.
There's no line to cross now. It's just like the line's been sort of swept away. And you know, this is the great failing, and this is what the history books will show, right? Is that one of the great guardrails of American democracy is the gatekeepers within the two major parties remaining responsible. And putting forward responsible candidates, they just completely abrogated that duty in 2016. You know, it looked like during the sort of the primary season that the party would, and there was a lot of talk about, there was a lot written about that the party would, if it came to that crisis moment where Trump was going to be the candidate, they'd pull off some magical maneuver to stop it happening. Right? It didn't happen. Became the candidate. Maybe the Republicans thought they were going to lose anyway, so it didn't matter. But the behaviour of Republicans since his election, with the, you know, very occasional exception, whether it's, you know, John McCain or Mitt Romney or someone who has spoken out against him, the entire party has just totally given up on right and wrong and morality and country, really. I mean, you know, what Trump is doing to America, which is trashing its reputation, trashing its institutions. None of that is conservative. He's a radical president. He's not a conservative president, right? And they're just letting it happen. And it's just, I think history will judge them very, very unkindly.
I love what you said there, because it feels radical, and it feels like some of the energy of this movie is talking about how radical it is to overcome and to silence these mechanisms, because like the mechanisms of power, like the mechanisms of, you know, keeping things in check here. It's like the FBI knew there was nastiness and bad stuff going on in the CIA, and they were all getting squashed. And at that time, it like feels like that it took them a while to like these stories to break, and then the public to know about it, that they just, you know, they click back into gear. But when you trash your, you know, you trash your local institutions, when you trash your judicial system, when you trash your intelligence agencies, it's like at the end of this, if he doesn't get reelected, which, you know, by some crazy thing, he absolutely could get reelected. But if he doesn't, what does a Republican candidate ever do again? Like, I think that I think it's like that whole thing of like, you scorch the earth, you know, like, you know, some rally car drivers drive their cars so hard. Like, we don't drive our cars that we drive to the supermarket in or to work every day like a rally car drives a car, because when they do, they can blow the engine and then the car dies. And it's like the whole engine of what you guys have got here without the candidate, it just like crashes and burns. And it also shows the whole flaws and the like blatant propaganda of all of the news machine, the propagandistic sort of Fox News machine that surrounds around Republicans, because no one's been objective. No one's been able to say anything. It's like so rare now. Like the other day, I think it was Hannity on Fox News actually admitted to, I'm happy to wear a mask because I want baseball to come back. And it was like everyone was like, look, even he said something that was against what the president said. These are the cracks. These are the things. And I think you're so right. It's like once you, if you completely enslave yourself to that cult of personality, and even at this time, you know, Nixon himself had a cult of personality and a cult of, you know, these folk who are doing all this nasty stuff around him, and sort of cutting corners and doing all this political malfeasance. But it takes a long time to recover after that, because just no one wants to hear from them again.
Yeah. And I think it depends, you know, I mean, it's hard to be confident of any electoral contest nowadays after the last 5 years or so, right? I think it's more likely at this stage, speaking right now, that Joe Biden wins this election.
Yeah.
Like I do. I just think he's – I know the polls, we distrust the polls now, but he is so far ahead and so clearly ahead in so many of the battlegrounds that Obama had that Hillary lost to Trump. You've just got to think that there is a great sort of corrective moment about to happen. Now, obviously, I'm not going to count those chickens, and I think it's going to be the most chaotic and brutal next 4 months as a campaign that we've ever seen in history. Like Trump will pull out every stop. I wouldn't put it past large scale electoral fraud. So who knows where it'll go? But if best case scenario, Joe wins big. Right, and it's taken as a denouncement of Trumpism that Americans tried that experiment. They went for the outsider. It was a disaster. They rejected it. They don't want it anymore. Maybe the Republican Party can return to some semblance of respectability. I don't know, but so much of their base now, the base that they have cultivated purposefully, is beyond that. Right, it is beyond mainstream candidate.
He hasn't done anything that actually. Some of those people rightly were excited about, which is he was going to hold Wall Street to account on certain things, cancel, you know, certain strangleholds that they had on the economy, help to boost and bolster American production and things like that. And it's like, none of that has foundationally changed, even material change, even in the slightest. It was like, there was consumer confidence, which then had low rates of unemployment, et cetera. But like now, the thing you have to credit, this is the thing that I think I constantly apologize to when I talk to American guests on the show. I'm like, I'm really sorry to say this, but our country's response, even with a conservative leader, has been so refreshing, because our country's response to the COVID-19 is like that the Prime Minister, who knowingly knows that he's not the expert, is deferring what our action should be to experts like our chief medical officers, who then say, this is what we should do, and then we do that. And now we and places like New Zealand and places like Italy, who had it really bad, are all starting to open up. We have sports again, and we can go to the shops, and even Victoria, which is in a bit of strife at the moment, and borders are about to close. Like, again, they're taking really extreme, but, you know, I think corrective actions that they need to squash the virus and, you know, still maintain the protection of all of our people. And yeah, it's a balmy time, man.
And again, we still have plenty of our conspiracy theorists who are on Reddit and on, you know, 8chan or QAnon forums, and like, that has infected Australia to an extent.
Yes.
But as with, you know, as we were talking before about Paul and Hanson, it is still thankfully on the fringes, and hopefully it'll stay there.
I was just going to say, can they figure out what happened to Harold Holt? I mean, look, if Australian 8chan and 4chan really wants to do something, there's a conspiracy for you. A Prime Minister goes for a swim and never returns. Where's the great TV series? I want that. Like, you know, like, let's talk about real conspiracies at those times.
Imagine if that happened now. Imagine if that happened in the age of 4chan and Reddit. It would, you know.
If anyone who listens to this show is a 4chan or Reddit warrior, hello, thank you for listening. Enjoy it. I hope you do. But no, there's, you know, I think there are some, you know, that's the fun. I think that's where people, this film talks about, like, it harnessed a conspiratorial energy, and it still does to a certain extent, and it flames it. And, you know, a lot of us, when we're sort of younger, whether we are pursuing journalism such as yourself, or you're just interested, movies like this and JFK, they're gateways into that. And you can totally go down rabbit holes and look at all this stuff. But I think the more that you can be objective about what the facts are, it's like, it's never one thing in its completion, because I think in all those conspiracy things, it feels like if it was a five paragraph news story, it's like three paragraphs of fact, and then paragraphs four and five are off the reservation. And so you end up going like, some of this stuff makes sense, I don't think we've quite gotten to that. And I think it's also a bit of our national character, you know, having that, you know, that being largely a Commonwealth country and a bit of a no BS country. It feels like when anyone talks in that, you know, those flowery tones, that natural tall poppy, like, we're going to cut you down, that's too filibuster, that's nonsense. It just goes out the window. It doesn't seem to have the same traction.
I do have one friend. We have a WhatsApp group with a bunch of sort of our school friends that we stay in touch. And one of them recently went down some kind of weird rabbit holes, talking about, you know, how some light machine can cure coronavirus and stuff, which apparently is a thing. But watching the way my other friend piled on him and just said, mate, what are you doing? Wake up to yourself. This is not, we don't care for this.
Don't make us, we will curate this WhatsApp group and you'll be out.
Exactly.
I'll share with you here is, I also have like a big friends group, WhatsApp group. And, at the beginning of it, I had a couple of my friends who work with the government and a couple of friends who, let me just say, are delinquents. and who are also in the same WhatsApp group having arguments about the preliminary response in Australia to coronavirus. And I just went in there and I was watching this volley back and forth, and I went, okay guys, see ya. I'm out. This is where Blake exits, and it's been real, and I'll come back when you guys are done, because I can't read nonsense back and forth. And I think, and similarly, there was a pile on. And then one of my friends, this is the other typical sort of shit story Aussie thing to do, is that one guy just kept baiting our one friend who just wouldn't let it go, like just going, oh, what about this and what about that? And he felt like he was just like prodding him. And we were texting him going, stop this. I don't want any notifications on my phone from this stupidity. And he's laughing.
So, look,
I think that there is that if you, foundationally, fortunately, but also, you know, in the psyche of this country, we haven't had any of those huge, you know, we haven't had a JFK and we haven't had a Watergate necessarily, and we haven't had some of these other things that are, you know, that are foundational to the American psyche now.
Like all the presidents then, Watergate was a genuine conspiracy.
Yes. Right?
It was the powerful conspiring amongst each other to try and pull off something devious and dastardly. Conspiracies happen. The powerful do try to hold on to their power in devious ways. I think, unfortunately, America has just kind of taken the wrong lessons from Watergate, which was right, like that ultimately those institutions worked and that those institutions are important and those institutions should be strengthened, not destroyed, that objective journalism should be supported and enabled, not, discredited and torn down, because they are the ones that will expose the powerful's misdeeds, right? And that's, now the media is still doing that work. The media is still exposing wrongdoing, but now people don't trust what they're reading. They don't hear it. It just becomes part of some big swirl of scandal and misinformation and propaganda, and no one knows what to believe, and everyone's got Facebook brain worms, and it's a mess. That institution doesn't work properly anymore.
And what's so strange, Adam, you just put it so rightly, which is that, like, they're still doing it. Like, I've mentioned on the show a few times, like Jodie Cantor and Megan Twohey and Ronan Farrow with Catch and Kill. Like, they are, like, as pure examples of, like, real rigorous investigative journalism going so hard in this country and, like, in the international community and, like, really embracing movements. And, there's even Amber Schultz, who is going to be a guest on the show, like, is currently part of a twofer investigative journalistic team diving into everything going on surrounding the Jeffrey Rush stories, which has been very fascinating for Crikey. And what's been really interesting is when you look at it, for some things, people are like, oh, that's amazing. That's incredible. And they just will take it. And even sometimes from the same institutions, like it's the same, like it's either the New York Times. It's like 1 week, the New York Times. Great. Yes. Bastion of objective journalism, bastion of the last gasp of like pure, like objective investigative journalism that can dedicate months of your lives and witnesses and, bulletproof legal arguments to have all of your I's dotted and T's crossed. And then the next minute they report on something that is like, in the president's speech of today, 90 factual inaccuracies were said, and like, look at the Times. And it's like, what do you mean? That was the same paper that just said this.
I mean, the difference, I guess, is that Harvey Weinstein's not a partisan figure, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So he's not a political figure. And that's what's gone wrong, I think, in American society, is hyper-partisanship took over to the point where it's party above country.
Yes.
It's party above truth. It's party above objectivity. And in America's case right now, it's personality above those things. And look, personally, I've never lived in America, but I watch it closely. Personally, I blame Fox News. I mean, it was the catalyst. It both tapped into something, but it also perpetuated something, which is this just blind hyper-partisanship that doesn't care about double standards. It doesn't care about – it's just shameless. It is so shameless. And a whole generation of conservatives got inculcated into that. And it's just – I don't know how you undo that. I don't know if you can.
And I think that also, like, even, the Sky News equivalent in Australia right now, which is just basically purporting to be Australia's equivalent to Fox News, hasn't quite gotten the same stranglehold, and also gets heavily criticised, because for the same times that they're on there, they do have some, quite good objective journalists who've been at other publications and stuff like that will come on there and do some of their stuff. And then they've got these individual programs that are sort of cults of personality that kind of people can tap into and give a platform to just nonsensical, like, blathering. And I think that's the 24-hour news cycle mixed in with Fox News is a potent cocktail, because, as you said, like, we in this country haven't constantly had the battle of what the factual battleground is. Yes, some of our media companies, like, purport whatever, just sort of toe the government line to the largest extent, which is a challenge in and of itself. But I think that there hasn't been an alternative. There doesn't need to be – sometimes with a fact, there doesn't need to be an alternative. It just needs to be that's what the fact is. And like, there can't be an agreement. Like you said, there's no line. The line's been blown away. And I think that this shoe leather journalism and trying to hear right now in this moment, for some of these folks, it's unconscionable, even in the age that it was. It's unconscionable that government power is doing weird stuff, you know. And in a post JFK, you know, the context of this movie, we haven't really spoken about, but like in the context of this movie, in a post JFK world, you understand now that some of these people might have already had it in their gut that, oh, powerful forces can disrupt the country. You know, our president was killed, and that then led into like a whole lot of political uncertainty, civil rights movement, et cetera. Nixon comes in, there's wars, there's all those sorts of things.
Yep.
But you know that in the back of their mind, when this happens, it's like, it's not an outlandish thing to think of that there's conspiratorial forces at work. And so I think we've been quite lucky in Oz that we haven't had that go wrong. Cause it feels like the smaller community seems that things just come out way faster. they seem to be exposed with greater speed.
And look, we have, you know, garden variety kind of corruption on a regular basis. And we have politicians on all sides who think they're really hot shit and think that they're sort of much more powerful and influential they are. And they go around swinging their big dicks and thinking they're great. And they usually come unstuck. There hasn't been any kind of, that we know of, any kind of grand conspiracy.
Don't start that. I just felt a WhatsApp start beeping in your pocket.
Yeah, that's it. It's lighting up. Thankfully we haven't had those kind of searing experiences that have kind of changed the Australian psyche in that way. Mm. I do fear kind of the contaminant from the United States, and I think Facebook is just an extremely irresponsible actor that allows all this bullshit to seep through every aspect of our society. So I worry about that, but yeah. Bloody hell, I'd rather be here than in the United States. That's for damn sure.
Yeah, it's a harsh thing that I say to folks. You know, a lot of being doing this show and being so close to so many of my American friends and folk who have supported the show, who are going through everything that they're going through over there, and all I can like shout out is empathy, and all I can say is that there's a spare room at my place if you can ever get to Oz again. But yeah, you know, yeah. Like, you know, you look at some of the countries that have had the right reactions to this sort of thing and haven't turned a virus into a partisan thing and done that. And, you know, where, you know, people are like, I don't know if I'll ever go to a movie again. You know, these movie loving folk who love this show and listen and stuff like that. Like, I don't know if I'm going to go to a movie in 2020. And I'm like, I'm going next Friday. I'm going in Oz because, you know, this is what's happening. So look, it's a fascinating thing. You do feel like there's still, like you said, even if it was a course correction with a Biden figure, there's still a significant amount of work that entire country needs to do to kind of get itself back on the right track.
Indeed, yeah. Yep.
Look, mate, this has been a really great convo. I want to say thank you so much for being a part of the show. Thank you so much for sort of giving some insight of what it's like to be on both sides of this thing. And especially, it's so fascinating to hear about other countries, you know, especially in the Western world, broadly in the Western world, looking over at America and seeing that drums up the concerns. And I think the comparison and contrast should be really fascinating for folks listening. So, mate, I just want to say a huge thank you and best of luck with your new place and best of luck with your WhatsApp conspiracies and your friends. And hopefully none of them are set ablaze in your pocket after they get to listen to this show.
Thanks, mate. Good to be here.
Thank you very much to Mr. Adam Guttrell. Adam, you can find on Twitter at Adam Guttrell and at a press secretary conference near you, I guess, in Canberra. Adam, thank you so much for the great convo, mate. Real great insights coming from on the ground in Aussie journalism and just his opinions on, you know, those aspirational qualities of politics, trying to make change out there to make positive change for the community. Thank you so much for being a part of the show. Guys, thank you so much for listening. It's a banger of a week. We've got lots of great episodes and this is now the third of five episodes that are coming this week, and we've got an even more impressive lineup, if that is even possible, coming at you before you know it. Thank you so much for listening to the show. Please subscribe, rate, review this bad boy. It really, really helps. Thank you so much for listening to the show. We'll catch you on another episode of All the President's Minutes tomorrow.